time for The Daily Review, a podcast dedicated to reviews and discussion of TV, movies, and books. Look for us at Daily Review on Facebook and Twitter and dailyreview.com on the web. That's DaleyReview.com.
This is Paul Daly, and I'm here with my wife, Caroline.
Hi, guys.
And we're here to talk about the ninth episode of the second season of HBO's The Leftovers.
Hope you guys had an awesome Thanksgiving break. We sure did. We're super glad we got to take a couple days off and have a nice holiday, but we're ready to get back to talking about Leftovers.
This episode is called 10-13.
So we start off with the song White Lines.
Yeah, we're in a bathroom. You can see the paper towels lined up along the counter, and it's...
Man, I miss that.
Yes.
Drug paraphernalia?
No, just regular old paper towels. And
not drug paper towels.
And a familiar face pops up into view, having just sucked in.
Doing that.
Yeah. And it's Meg.
Yeah. You know what? It's a funny thing. I wonder if it's because Liv Tyler is an attractive person and that she's, you know, kind of well-groomed and those types of things, that it never occurred to me at all to question her background before we met her. You know, it appeared that she was dressed nicely. She, you know, was a young person looking to get married.
Yeah, you always would want...
She seemed put together.
For some reason, you'd kind of assume that she was just, an A-list, put together, kind of meant for something kind of person.
Yeah, and I don't know if that's just because of she's attractive, like I said, and because she just basically looks put together. But many times, you know, I've compared The Leftovers to another series, Fear the Walking Dead, and they portray a drug addict, and they portray it, obviously, extremely differently.
Yes.
You know, that person is
a born loser.
Shambles.
Yes.
Right, but here's the thing. Why is Meg not a born loser in your mind? Just because she's a pretty person. That's it. She's pretty. That's kind of just it. And she keeps herself looking neat and clean and all that kind of good stuff. So that's super interesting. It was a nice little switch up on us. So Meg looks at herself in the mirror and coaches herself to smile.
This bathroom is in a fancy restaurant where Meg comes back out and she meets her mother.
She's sitting out there and they're eating and doing the kind of, you know, woman luncheon chatting that we all would do if we were eating with our mom. What did you think about their relationship? What did you think about their back and forth?
It reminded me of, it reminded me of sort of a Gilmore Girls kind of relationship without all of the baggage.
So we're going to say that that's with Emily Gilmore and Lorelai Gilmore.
Yes.
So the senior grandma Gilmore.
Right, not Lorelai. Rory and Lorelai.
No, not even a little bit.
No.
But definitely, I agree with you that there seemed to be, you know, Meg seemed to like she was kind of holding back, like she didn't want to tell a lot about her life or what was going on. You know, and the mom was very much trying to pry and be like, well, just give me a hint. Just give me an idea of like, when will the wedding be? Will it be a spring? Will it be summer? Like, you know, tell me something. And it's kind of, for me, you know, I don't know as a man how much wedding planning you've ever really thought about. But as a girl, you know, it would be absolutely normal to talk about at least some generalities with your mom.
But if you recall from the first season, Meg was really just pushing off this wedding thing just indefinitely.
Exactly. So that's part of the question I have is that was the reason why she was being a little dodgy about the questions because she doesn't want to give her mom information because they have such a bad relationship? Or is this really about like, no, she just doesn't want to come clean, that she really is not super interested in going through with this wedding?
I bet that's it.
So it makes me wonder if really did they have like actually kind of a, you know, a fairly normal relationship?
Probably. I couldn't say. I mean, I'm not a daughter, so I can't say for sure. But like the scene where about the boots, you know,
that was so awkward. Oh, my God. When she's like, you let me treat you all the time. And she's all like, now that I kind of feel like was more about being not that she's like old, but an older daughter. So it's not like she's 20. She appears to be, you know, 25, 30 or whatever. Like, they never talk about Meg having a job or anything. But one can assume, I guess, that she's living independently, right?
Yeah, right.
I mean, I assume. So I guess then talking about, like, owing your mom money because, you know, you forgot your wallet. Super awkward. I agree with you. Like, the whole way that conversation went, awkward as anything. So Meg's got to pull out her checkbook and she's like, okay, what's today's date? And the mom says, it's the 13th, but that's unlucky. So Meg actually says out loud, October 14th. Thank you for the loan. And like hangs her mom the check. So now we've got our time frame. We know exactly that we are on October 13th. That is our 10-13.
And for those of us whose cogs aren't turning, that's our 10-13.
There you go. You got a 10-13. Right when Meg is getting ready to get a little antsy again, her mom says, oh, there's something I've got to tell you.
Meg, whose cocaine hit apparently has worn off just now, says, hold that thought. I need to use the bathroom again.
She actually says, I got to pee, which her mom reminds her is not nice lady talk. Again, totally hearkening back to that Gilmore Girls, because I know for a fact there is a talk about what ladies do and don't do with old between Lorelai and Emily.
Yes. So she takes off.
But hold on. I do have like a wee question on that. Now, neither of us are going to be able to answer that. But you as a listener, my God, anyone out there who is an active or past cocaine user, is this like remotely normal? Or is this like, holy mackerel, you had to go two times in the bathroom to go sniff up your
stuff?
What's
up with the cocaine of today?
I don't know. Maybe is it weak? I don't know. Now, okay, who is the other person that I know that we've talked about who was using coke? It was Uma Thurman in Pulp Fiction. And we kind of talked about her just a wee bit, right? When we were talking about the adrenaline shot and the epinephrine and all that kind of jazz.
Yeah.
Now, she did use it twice, didn't she? Throughout the evening, right?
Yeah, she used it at Jackrabbit Slim's, I know. And then she wanted another hit when she got back home. And that's when she mistakenly snorted up the heroin instead.
I mean, we can assume she's a pretty avid user, right? And here she was, like, basically, you know, went hours and hours between hits. So she's my only comparison in my pop culture. That's all I got, friends. I don't hang out enough with the coke users of the world. But you're right. Maybe she got a really sad batch.
Maybe. Used to complain.
You know, if I was a drug dealer and like I had any vibe that the departure was coming, I'd totally be selling like baby powder to people. Be like, whatevs, you might depart.
So after the hit, Meg comes back out and finds her mom on the ground with someone giving her chest compressions. And Meg is pretty much just stunned.
I thought she had a really strange response to this, honestly.
Like lack of,
yeah. Now I know there's some people who for me, honestly, I would like get down on my knees right next to my mom and I would be absolutely in there talking to her and saying her name and trying to see if she had just like fainted or what had happened to her. Or if you had like a different type of personality, I would think you might yell like, call 911, you know, or is there a doctor in the house, or like one of those kind of things. Any which way, just standing there, where if you were a passerby, you'd be like, those two people are not related. That woman's just like an onlooker. That seemed like a very weird response, right? Now, is that cocaine?
No, response? She should be, that's a
she
stimulant.
She should be hyper?
She should be.
Should have been like, blah, 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 I'll do the chest compressions. I'll jump on her.
Yeah, she should be going nuts.
So, hey, previously in that little dinner conversation, the waitress brought over a salad and the mom's like, I'm sorry, you know.
I asked for no walnuts.
Right. But she says it politely, Polly. And so, you know, they send it back. So when I saw her on the ground, I did have a moment because one of our children has a nut allergy. I actually did have a moment where I thought, you know, I wonder if she's like an anaphylactic shock or something. Now, here's why I say that. Because all of us who have kiddos or relatives or friends who have a nut allergy like that where you carry an epinephrine pen, it's very important that you like point that out and actually go administer it, because oftentimes it's
not
is,
just stand there.
Right. But hold up. So then what if she does know? She didn't even say anything. Like what if that was all like, oh no, I wish I knew what to do. And like really, we know she asked for no walnuts. There's a fair chance she had some sort of nut allergy. Think about that for a sec. Like, whoa.
I had not considered that angle at all.
Put that in your pipe and smoke it.
So some, let's call it Underground Railroad slave music. Choir music.
Spiritual, if you will.
Starts playing in the background. Seems a little out of place.
A little, but we've had some kind of like old, kind of jazzy, not not jazzy, but like old jazz, where the singer, the crooners are kind of like singing kind of a sorrowful tune. This song is Waiting in the Water, and we've definitely heard it many times before, not in this show. But Paul looked it up, and he had a really good little clip for it. It turned out that Harriet Tubman specifically used this song to pass on the message to runaway slaves to make sure that they get into the water, essentially eliminating their scent or their track for people or dogs or anybody who might be tracking their whereabouts. If you wade into the water, then basically you break the trail. So that was a really big deal. And honestly, wow, what a little message to put out there in terms of old Meg here. I would like to go back to that mom thing. She kind of got somebody off her trail there, didn't she? Like, huh, intrigue, right?
Music picks up with a new scene in a school bus.
The people on the bus seem to be singing the Wading in the Water song, right? It's kind of like it reminded me of like a field trip where everybody's like singing their like whatever type of little pass the time songs, right?
So and Meg is sitting next to her fiance, who I took advantage of our closed caption to remember. His name is Darren. I hadn't remembered that.
No clue at all.
Yes.
Oh, hey, I have to go back for just a second before we leave Mom. Did you know that the actress that played Mom was also the one who played the mom on Eight is Enough? And you want to know something super weird about that? Do you know what her maiden name was? Abbott on the show Eight is Enough. Now, that's nuts because in this show, The Leftovers, Meg's name is Meg Abbott. What a bizarro little thing, right?
I did not know that.
Bizarro fact. Moving on to Darren.
The bus stops and a park ranger comes on and he informs them that they're in the first couple weeks of their tours here in Miracle State Park, or National Park. And so we kind of get the idea that Meg and Darren are in the kind of the opening hours of what we have come to see as the established Miracle in the earlier episode this season. What they're experiencing right now is the very infancy of Miracle.
And clearly they have very, maybe not the visitor center and all that stuff isn't set up, but they do have an audio tour and they do have the golf carts and that kind of good stuff. So it turns out, not unlike Paul and I, who as a young couple would have started wandering around and doing silly little jaunts here, they went off on a little field trip to Texas to check out Jardin.
And they explain all the stuff. The audio stop number 7, the crack, that happened on October 14th as a result of some sort of underground pressure. It's explained on the tour.
But that was kind of important because they clearly say that while some people believe it was from fracking from nearby towns, what it actually was a gas line explosions, and that many towns around had also experienced the same thing. Now, this part was a little like, huh? Because we have absolutely seen a manhole cover blow off in the same type of way that would have caused that crack in the road. That happened with Kevin. Now, here's the only, They said this happened in nearby cities. Well, we know that Jardin is in Texas. Mapleton, New York is not considered a nearby city. So interesting that they just didn't say, like, this happened nationwide or worldwide or something like that.
They also explain Audio Stop 13 as Cecilia's place, where the lady in the bridal dress considered it good luck to be wearing this wedding dress at the time of the departure and has since worn the same exact dress every day ever since. And it explains all this stuff that this is ground we've covered in earlier podcasts and in the show.
It would come under the heading of like superstition and basically like because she was trying on the dress on October 14th and her town was spared, she felt that was something that she needed to do every day. Basically, like, you know, same thing as old Jerry and the goat. You know, he killed the goat that day. Got to keep killing goats.
Darren is humoring Meg the whole time because he feels like he has come along on this trip.
Just like sightseeing, it seemed like, right? Just like, oh, yeah, let's go see that wacky little town.
And they're taking golf carts all over the town and a bunch of people are. And so there are golf carts everywhere. Meg asks for a unscheduled stop.
Hey, on that crack in the road, one of the lines that he actually said is that they put that clear box around it to leave it as a reminder.
Oh.
We hear that.
That's a big word.
We hear that a bunch of times this episode. So they pull up to what we start to recognize as old Isaac's casa.
Meg goes in alone.
At first, Darren's like, Meg, really? Another psychic situation?
She makes it clear that she's been going to mediums of all stripes all over for some amount of time to be, she's been searching for something.
Now, while it's not exactly clear at this point, we do know that the mom said, oh, I have something I need to tell you right before she passed. So we can gather that, you know, okay, maybe that's what she's trying to find out. But also, you know, maybe she just needs to feel some amount of closure. Meg does say that this place is different, it's special, and that this guy is going to be the real deal.
Especially since he's from here.
Right. That's pretty key.
They chat. She sees that there are handprints all over the room, just like when John visited. She also indicates to Darren that Isaac has only been doing this a couple of weeks. That is kind of interesting because if you remember when John burns his house down, we kind of got the idea that this is something that Isaac had been up to a short amount of time. And now the timeline is a little stretched out for,
yeah,
for
what
Isaac.
We find out is that he says, who do you want to reach? And she says, my mom. He said, you know, when did she pass? And she said, oh, it's, you know, it's been 2 years ago. And so then we can start putting it together. Okay, Isaac's only been doing it a couple of weeks. It's been 2 years since the departure. And we know that when John decides to go kick down doors, that's 3+ years past the departure. So Isaac's been doing it for like a full year. This is kind of puzzling to us because maybe John's just not very good at keeping up with the town's biz, but it seems like, you know, why...
Or Isaac reached a certain threshold of
I mean, there was certainly,
annoyance or...
There was
or,
a ton of people sitting out on the porch. The other thing is, it seemed like it depends on if you're doing something that makes money off of the town.
Yeah.
John has a particular...
Like when Brian Goodhart was... How it wasn't that he was selling the water, it's how much he was selling it for.
Right. He was, it was like one of those, what do they call it? It's like when,
like faith healing.
No. When you're like benefiting from a catastrophe, it's like gouging, like price
right,
gouging
okay,
kind of thing.
Yeah.
So there definitely seems like he didn't want any of that kind of biz going on, which in all honesty, I guess that does kind of fall on like the authorities about price gouging. It happens again, since we do live in Texas and we're a hurricane kind of state. It is something that people actually do watch out for, price gouging during, you know, a hurricane time or a catastrophe disaster kind of time. They do have a conversation where Meg tries to act like she's kind of cool, like, oh, it's been 2 years, I'm cool. But then, come on, hello, put it in context. You're carrying around your mom's whoopee sweater here, and you're sealing.
You're at the psychic
medium.
You're
seeing psychics, right. So you're not exactly healed up here. I totally loved the writing on this, although it did seem like the wrong character was saying it, when Meg's all like, I brought my mom's sweater, and Isaac's like, chili? That was funny, but it was weird because not every character can talk exactly like John and Erica do, right? Like, you can't banter in exactly the same way, right?
Well, they're from the same town, so...
Oh, I see. Wit just comes with your town citizenship card. Makes sense.
He isn't interested in having her make a handprint, because handprints, I guess, are a future-telling device. He's not a medium that needs an article of the departed or the deceased's belongings. So what he does need is for the person who is there to chew up some stuff and spit it into his hand, and then he mashes that stuff around in his hand.
It looked kind of like when she spit it out, it was black. It looked kind of like a chewed up prune. I did some looking on it, and there definitely is different shaman types who specifically I noted that Brazil was brought up, which I know like our places that we're kind of wondering about that seem to be special are Brazil and Australia specifically. So when I saw Brazil, I was like, oh boy, like, I don't know. I kept reading about tobacco as something that people would like chew and spit out and then like read it. I couldn't figure out if that's what that was or if it was just something similar. One of the things that Isaac says that reminded all of us was that there was kind of like a false idea that Meg was lucky because Meg knew where her mother had gone. She watched her pass away. She knew that she had officially passed away and what had happened to her. And only like 24 hours later, we have the departure where so many people were lost and there was just no answers. It was really good, I thought, that Isaac acknowledged the fact that, you know, having your mama pass away and basically 24 hours later, the whole world goes nuts and nobody cares about you. Nobody cares about your grief. Nobody cares what happened to her. Now we've got this whole huge situation going on. I'm sure there's like so many people who could say they had some sort of life tragedy that happened on, you know, 9/10. And nobody gives a crap because once 9/11 happened, that just fell right away. So that was probably really based on some really true stories of people.
And the way he put that was a little more sincere than when Matt said the same thing.
He did.
When he said her grief was hijacked, it sounded very in this kind of clinically insincere kind of way that was just
probably
sort of
insensitive, certainly. Yeah. I mean, he thought he was just Mr. Facts Man, right? So he was going to tell the facts on everything. But you're right. Isaac was definitely like, I get it. I totally get why you're here. He kind of flattened out this chewed-up black ball on his hand. And he said, you know, okay, so tell me, what do you want? What do you want to know?
And she explains that she wants to know what her mother was going to say when she left to go to the bathroom in the restaurant.
Now, I feel for Isaac here because it seems like he's very much trying to protect Meg. And, you know, he says, look, here's the deal. If you're dying on your deathbed and you have been sick for a while, you know that you're passing away and you have a chance here to put your words together and come up with something that's very meaningful. But in the cases of a sudden death, you don't know what's going to happen to you. So what your last words could come off very stupid and very, very ridiculous. And so don't put too much weight in what these last words were because they weren't words that there was any true thought put in them.
Meg thinks he's making an excuse for not knowing, but he tells her walnuts. And that proves that he knows what was going on in her last moments because there's no way that he would know about the walnuts that she had sent back.
Yeah. And even he said, you know, she sent them back, but she was real polite about it. In true Leftovers fashion, of course, we now take the point of view of Darren waiting outside and Meg comes out. Now, how would you describe her face when she came out?
As she was walking, it was neutral.
Did you think it was? Did you think she was like kind of like stewing? I would not say that she came out looking angry exactly, but there was something a little twisted about how her face was coming off. It was like she was definitely thinking about whatever the words were.
Mm-hmm.
And she was clearly placing more meaning in them. I've seen a bunch of funny ideas that, like, you know, it was something like she's adopted or something like that. Okay, this is all like stupid because no one at lunch was like, oh, there's something I wanted to tell you, you know?
Mm-hmm.
No, that's totally stupid. You know, totally stupid.
No, I think that she was going to tell her something mundane, you know.
But then why would she be so affected by it? I think there has to be some spirit to the words that were either mean or cutting or in some way was going to tell her something that she was, I don't know, maybe her mom was being insensitive about something that she was actually going to be upset about, whatever these words were. But it seems to me like if she just said, I bought a new comforter, I just like, I don't see her coming out with that face on, you know, if they were truly just nothing words.
Whatever it is that he told her.
They did get to Meg.
She says to Darren, oh, he wasn't the real deal, with this totally false smile on her face.
Completely false. You know what, though? How many times have we heard the real deal this season? I do not walk around saying, oh, hey, Paul, was that the real deal? Like, that's such like a weird, funny little packaged phrase. I thought it was weird. I remembered that George Brevity had said that he was coming to find out if the departure, the second departure, was a real deal. And then Nora was like, the real deal? And then Meg's all, he's not the real deal. Like, I don't know. Maybe a writer is stuck on it and I'm putting too much attention on it. But it is not really a modern phrase.
Wasn't that like an 80s or 90s soda commercial phrase, like Diet Coke, it's the real deal, or, you know, something.
The real thing.
The real thing. Oh.
But yeah, but still, I'm totally with you. And it's kind of dorky to say. It makes sense that George Brevity says it. Does it make sense that a young, what we're going to consider hip, you know, sort of modern woman would say it? I don't know. It seems antiquated.
Meg walks past him and ends up sitting at a park bench outside of the courthouse building in the town square. And she's kind of just sniffing and smelling at that woobie sweater of her mom's.
Oh, it's so sad. And she's crying. Now, again, this is kind of confusing because, you know, she didn't show a lot of emotion about her mom passing. But, you know, she's clearly broken up about it.
Well, you remember she brought that sweater to the GR house. And this is probably the sweater that Lori had to take away from her later.
You're totally right, because it was that pale blue sweater.
Yeah.
Ugh, dude. That's extra barfy. Really, really barfy.
And then who should try to cheer up Meg but Evie?
Evie. So she also uses a little throwback to our brand new theme song and offers her a baby carrot, because she says that with baby carrots, you can't cry while you eat them. As y'all know, in the theme song, it says some people think we're going to come back like
bunch of carrots,
little green beans. Y'all, we don't talk like that here, okay?
And the carrot doesn't really seem to work.
Well, it does. She kind of sucks it up a little bit. And so, you know, Evie's like, I would tell you a joke, but I don't really know any. And now, I think that's a little funny thing to say, but man, the next line was like a jaw dropper.
So Meg tells Evie a joke. It's a joke we've already heard this season. It's about a broken pencil. It's a knock-knock joke.
I think that the punchline, it's pointless, is pretty key.
It's the sort of joke you might tell if you prefer to wear white.
I would say you've got some white tendencies in you. So she introduces herself and says, I'm Evie. Meg introduces herself. Finally, Evie says, I'm sorry you didn't find what you're looking for. No one ever does. So what do you think, Paul? Now we know that it's not that Miracle has been open all that long. Not really. Because we know they're pretty young. So already at this point, Evie's already, like, had her fill of people coming looking for answers.
We know that John, in the timeline, has been in jail or prison already. So living in that house with him and knowing how he feels about Jordan might have already rubbed off on her.
Okay. I'll go with that.
Because we don't know for sure exactly what made him feel that way. We just kind of know that he does feel that way.
Well, and I would say that if you are later a GR member, that Evie is most certainly showing the types of comments that those who are kind of fed up with people's responses to the departure, you know, Evie's certainly showing those signals.
Off in the distance, someone is making an announcement that the first bus is about to head back out of the park, and Meg wants to be on it. She and Darren get back on the bus, but before she steps foot on the bus...
I noticed that there was like that kind of, you know how they play that background sound effect that's like boom, like that booming kind of sound?
Yeah.
It was playing that, and it stops, and Meg like turns on her heel and hawks a loogie on Miracle's sacred ground. To me, there is no doubt that that message is pretty clear. She absolutely spits on them. In many, many cultures, that's kind of considering like putting like almost like a hex on something, you know, like spitting on it.
It's an insult in almost all of them, I think.
Oh, absolutely. But more than that, too. Kind of like it's kind of like a witch's kind of
curse.
Yeah, like a curse. Exactly like a curse. I say hex. I wrote on my notes.
A pox.
Putting a hex on the town. Yeah. So back on our way.
And wading in the water.
So again, I wonder about all this biz. I wonder so much that, you know, every time they play Wading in the Water, what I really hear is, cover your tracks. So there's like all this debauchery that kind of comes along with. Every time I hear that and I see Meg, I'm like, ooh, you got some crap going on.
And the director plays a trick on us here, because we get on the bus, but the point of view switches to a different bus. It is a children's school bus where, as it rounds a corner in a regular old neighborhood.
It very much looked like we were still in Jordan in so many ways. I know we couldn't have been, but boy, we've been down those streets, and I'm telling you, it kind of looks like we're in the same town.
A group of GR are standing in the street, and they block the way for the bus, and they force their way onto the bus, grab the bus driver out, pull him out of the street. And
Meg, like, saunters onto the bus, holds up a grenade, pulls the pin, and just casually rolls it down the aisle, hops back off, GR slide the crowbar into the door so the children just can scream and scream and scream.
She walks away and smiles.
Oh my God, did you totally think, like, you know, for the longest time she was walking away and she didn't look back at all, which, you know, that's like a total action movie kind of move, right? It reminded me of like Die Hard when they just keep walking, and like even sometimes the explosion like blows their hair forward, but they're just like smirking as they go. It's like so wicked. I put badass villain face.
Well, we've seen from Guest that these...
Yeah, do you guys remember that? So on Guest, when Nora is walking into the convention, a kind of protester type hands her a grenade and pulls the pin.
Yeah, so we know we've seen this gimmick before.
We have, and that grenade did not blow up. And they never show us, at least at this point, whether or not anything happened to the school bus.
Yeah, still pretty scary imagery.
Heck yeah. My God. So we are driving up to a large house, and Meg gets out of a black car and goes up, and she has a key around her neck, like a house key, and uses it to unlock the door. There's this like pulsating sound in the background that I noted. She walked into, it's kind of like a large like mansion. So she's walking through several rooms. There's a light pale blue on the walls. It totally reminded me of her mother's sweater. She walks into a large room that just has a desk with three people sitting there. Clearly, this is going to be a situation where she is going to be questioned.
Right. This is
a council.
Right. A GR council. And she is in trouble.
Absolutely. So they write bus ? And hold it up. She's like, what about the bus? Instantly, they like recoil like, I cannot believe you have the gall to talk with your words out loud here. So she's like, oh, if you want to have a conversation, let's just have a conversation. So, hey, that middle lady, who, by the way, I totally recognized as Tara's mom from True Blood.
Oh.
She was sitting dead center and leading the questions. She reaches her hand out to the other GR councilwoman and is like, cease with the writing. She's like, listen, you know, what is up? I thought after the dog incident that, you know, we kind of had this stuff under control here, but now you got the bus situation going on.
It's an argument about old versus new, apparently.
Well, it kind of answers the question about whether that grenade blew up, because Meg says nobody got hurt. Like, what's the big deal?
Yeah.
So clearly that it didn't go off. She said that they were forgetting. And, you know, it did remind me of, like, if you ask kids these days who are maybe, like, 10 and under anything about 9/11, they don't know what you're talking about. At best, they can give you a little historical account, but they certainly don't have any of the actual fear or emotion behind it. So the fact that she chose an elementary school bus is what it sounded like by the screaming. Those kids, you know, say they were 6, 7 years old and the departure is now 3+ years ago. They were only like 3 or 4 years old when this happened. You know, in terms of there being a generation just sort of starting to absolutely go about their business and not think about the departure at all. She's right.
She wants to know, why are we not stepping it up? Because everything that they are telling her are all the stock answers that she's been getting the entire time that she has been with the GR, and she's tired of hearing the same old violence is weak, blah, blah, blah.
She does ask specifically why they don't target children and
it attracts the authorities, basically.
Yeah, basically. And they don't allow the kids to live in the house and all that stuff. Actually, if you were a person who was a viewer who was like, I wonder why there are no GR children, this answered all that. Like, they don't deal with kids at all because basically there's a lot of unwanted attention with the authorities. This totally gets Meg's gall, man. She's like, so you're telling me that we stone each other and we don't really give a hoot about the authorities with a lot of the stuff we do, but yet we don't want to like ruffle feathers in other ways? Like, I'm confused.
I kind of picture this as like a changing of the guard kind of thing. Like, this is the Protestants versus the Catholics sort of things, you know?
There's a lot of give and take here. I mean, clearly, now it turns out that Meg's been contacting the heads of other households.
And she's not supposed to be.
She's not supposed to be. Also, apparently, she's been trying to purchase plastic explosives. And that's pretty nutballs, right?
Yes.
And Meg is like, look, what is the point of me standing outside smoking and staring at them until they come over and basically scream in my face when I could walk right up there and put my cigarette out in their eyeball? Bleh. Again, as a parent of a blind child, it barfs me out that they always want to go for the eyes. Last week, we had to put up with Windex in the eyeballs, freaking me out. But definitely, I understand the approach. Even early on in the season 1, we kind of sat around and were like, I don't get it. I don't get, like, how do they just take this screaming to their faces? Why don't they push back? Like, what's the deal? So I agree with you wholeheartedly that this was kind of the normal, I think very realistic evolution of the GR, because how many times do you think you could get screamed at in the face or have someone, you know, slapping at you, or like Nora turned the water hose on them? How many times do you think you could have that happen before you're like, hey, I hear that person over in Dubs Ferry wants to start smacking the person back in the face. I think you'd be like, you know what? I'm all for punching that guy in the nose when he spits in my eyes.
Well, speaking of Dobbs Ferry, that's where the next sanctioned GR event is supposed to take place.
Sounds like they have another one of those poster protests.
Yes, which Meg is not very enthusiastic about taking part in.
No. I thought this was like so clear. Clearly she's not going to do it. But she did the exact right thing, I guess, which was just be like, of course we are going to be there. We've been painting our signs all week. And they're like, you know, are you doing something else? She's like, oh, no, I'm not authorized to do anything else. Like, oh, Megert, you're killing me here.
And she said, oh, you can count on me. And they basically said, oh, like we could count on you for this. And then they throw down a picture of Tom.
Right. And so it turns out that old Tomster, even though he did yell with Lori several times in their episode earlier this season, guess he's still holy Tom in it.
He's hugging the pain away, and they've been losing GR members to him.
I thought that was pretty impressive, actually, that Tom was like really actually doing this. We
cut
head
away,
on over to, yes. Yeah, cut away to Tom.
In a Legionnaires' hall somewhere.
Right, and he's in there, he's given his spiel, and in from the back, we see Meg saunter in. With, I put, accompanied by sinister music.
And he's got a pretty good crowd. I don't know that it's completely full, but it's pretty full.
I thought it was really awesome that, like, I'm sure this is a part of his regular spiel to say he used to be afraid of using this power. But when he sees Meg, he, like, locks eyes with her and is like, but I'm not afraid anymore. I thought that that meant more than one thing.
He starts hugging the crowd, and eventually Meg comes up to the front of the room and she doesn't talk to him right away, but he doesn't shy away from her either.
Well, I think he tries to continue to play the part, because after all, the plastic pitcher's going around for donations. Now is not the time to break cover.
When they do embrace, she whispers into his ear, I can do this for real.
Gross.
Yeah, I think it gives him pause.
Does that mean I can hug you for real, or does it mean I can take your pain away for real? Does it mean like I can physically embrace you for real?
I think it meant take his pain away for real.
I also kind of think it means I can embrace you for real.
Well, it gave Tom food for thought.
Didn't it, though? So he opts to sit back on the stage and smoke a while.
Which meant blowing off a meeting later in Paramus.
Paramus!
Because Lori comes in later and finds him sitting on the stage and says, why weren't you in Paramus?
She's like, I rented the hall. Awesome. Tom is so over this crap. And Lori, I give her a little credit. She's like, did something happen? way to pick up on the cues here. Tom's sitting here in the dark, chain smoking on the stage. That is some good Scooby sense that something has happened.
And then Tom,
just lets it go.
He just has like a 4-barrel shotgun that he just blows all barrels at the same time.
So what are the high points? What does he blow out here?
Your book didn't work, so you pimp out your son so that you can stop running people over and not have to feel bad about leaving your family.
Ah, that was like bam, 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 bam. Well, Lori, not unlike how I might have felt some days, decides to get that chair out of her way and stride up to the front. And boy, the sound effects men, they definitely like gave it their best. It was like, whoosh!
It was like a running slap.
It was awesome. She like it was like her hand grew 10 times that day.
Yes.
Like it whooped the crap
out of
it.
Slapsgiving.
It was slapsgiving. It was like such a harsh slap. Well, Tom stands right up, and Tom is a good head and a half taller than Lori.
He does not move to touch her at all, though. He just...
But her first response that, like, I'm sorry. I'm sorry, but I think she was afraid he was going to womp her back.
He did not make any such movement.
He did not.
He just got out of her way and left the building.
So now we know what the big fight was that Lori had told Kevin. Basically, Tom and I had a little falling out. And it turns out, so that's why she's been looking for him.
So he went and slept in the park. This is
looks
apparently...
Looks like he's been drinking for a while. So he's out there.
This is the park where you take your dog, apparently. Where...
Yeah. Did you see specifically, though? It was an Australian Shepherd.
Oh, I did not note the breed.
It totally was. We know because a college roommate of ours got an Australian Shepherd and it howled like hell in our apartment. So yeah, that was an Australian Shepherd. It was strange, though. So, okay, WTF, Pete, is this the thing? This is what you do? Like, do you think these are dogs that have gone crazy? Though that dog looked cool as a cucumber.
Yeah.
Why are you getting rid of your dogs? What is this?
That was just a mean mom.
Oh. That was just a mean mom. That's a funny thing to say. Why do you think it was a mom?
Because that's who gets rid of dogs.
Oh, my God.
Or they make dads do it, but it's never the dad.
Okay, just like complete asterisks right now. I'm just like saying this out loud. This mom has never gotten rid of a dog. And in fact, this mom's all about bringing dogs home. So that is not the ways of the dailies. However, I could definitely see a complete comparison that basically Tom was this dog just left in a park to his own devices with nothing.
Oh, like a metaphor.
Like a metaphor, just like one.
Just like one.
So Tom finishes off his bottle and decides, you know what? If I want to get in touch with Meg, let me just retrace my steps. Like, where did I leave Meg last?
So he goes and finds a, looks like a warehouse kind of place where he goes.
Outside, it's marked 209 on the top of the building. 2.09. Ninth episode, second season.
Oh, you...
Catch it.
So he goes inside, nice and lit, and starts yelling at the GR members inside.
Oh, yeah, he's like... He's giving his very best slur.
I'll get to the point. He says, blow the whistle that brings Meg.
I like the part where he said, I just wanted to bring you to a great group therapy with my mommy. I was like, oh, Tom. Yes, but I loved it. You're right. The whole point was blow the whistle that brings Meg. Guess what? Somebody does.
I don't know if they blow the whistle, but they do bring Meg. But in the interim, they beat him up.
Well, wouldn't you?
I guess, that's just part of the deal. It's the price of doing business.
Well, maybe perhaps they remembered him as like a guy that got beat up, right? So Meg shows up and says, why are you here? What is up? What is your dealio here?
He says, I want to be a part of this. And she's like, no, you actually want to be a part of a family, Tom.
Well, he says that he wants the pain to go away. And Meg's all, why don't you just hug yourself? Oh, Megster. So Meg's all, you don't understand this. You want a family. Now here's where a little bean spillage. This is where you can tell that Jill and Tom have the same mother. Because this reminded me exactly of when Jill was in the church with Michael. And she's like, yeah, so my dad sleepwalks and blah, blah, blah. And basically blurts out like a bunch of information. Well, Tom is like, if I wanted a family, I would simply move to Texas. My dad and my sister moved there and blah, 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 blah. Well, guess what? Meg loves this information.
Yeah, she's like, where? Jardin. Mm-mm. Or no, he says Miracle.
Mm-hmm.
And she goes, oh, Jardin. Miracle is the park that surrounds it. And she starts to recite all of the audio tour facts.
Gross.
It protects it from the outside forces that would corrupt it or whatever else the audio tour says.
And then she starts to get under our skin and says, I just so happen to be headed there myself.
And White Lines starts to play again.
And she throws her head back for the longest maniacal laughter track that we've seen in quite some time.
Then there's a car ride that features a few lines that seem to have been created primarily just for the commercial.
I agree. Like sometimes in many shows, but this show has these lines. I agree with you. It was like created for the preview. Where you feel like the writer is looking directly at the audience person and talking to them.
Yeah, she says, oh, don't you? Aren't you excited to find out what happens next?
Well, like it's something like you enjoying the anticipation. It's so exciting to wait to see what happens.
I bet you can't wait to see what I do in Texas or something exactly, like that.
Exactly, exactly. And then we hear the familiar cheap chirp of the cricket sound.
Turns out Meg's ringtone is a cricket chirp.
What the what? So instantly, Paul, did you put together that we have heard that cricket, and now we know that Evie and Meg have met? Was your mind like, zoom, zoom?
Yeah, it was like, oh my God, has Meg been in Evie's house in that first episode, or was Meg...
I had a different one.
Or
I
was thinking, Evie kind of copying Meg with her own phone, or...
Yeah, that's a second. And then I'm going to go with the third, though, that it's a like a Go phone or like a burner phone that Meg and Evie have been in contact with one another. And so every time we heard that chirp, chirp sound that John was like looking for, it was actually just Evie's burner phone ringing for her to go get in contact with Meg.
When she starts talking, she's talking about the bridge and how she needs to go check it out. Tom is not much for small talk. And he just,
yeah, he finally just like unloads.
He just really wants to know why it is that she forced him to have sex.
He's all, why'd you F me? That is an awkward starter conversation for anybody, really, right? That's a hard line to start off with. Meg decides this needs a drink to accompany this. So she's like, ooh, look, a honky-tonk. Want to go dancing, Tom? But you know what that reminded me of? Do you know how in Batman, how Joker has that line about dancing with the devil?
You ever dance with the devil by the pale moonlight?
Okay. So her saying like, ooh, want to go dancing, Tom? To me, the only thing I thought of was that. Was like the, you're going to go dance with the devil, my friend. And he kind of did.
It was not a straightforward night for Tom, that's for sure. So they sit at the bar, and she starts drinking first, and Tom follows up. And they both reveal that they have what we call in the Damon Lindelof fandom world as daddy issues.
Absolutely. Meg reveals that her dad died as a baby, and that her mom remarried Elliot, and he wanted a family, so he did adopt her. She remembered that the judge gave her a lollipop and all this stuff. And then she looks off and is like, good old Elliot. It was said in such a way that made me wonder if Elliot was not a nice guy. She said that after a year, he left and never saw him again. Did it make you wonder for a second, Paul, like, could Elliot have been creeper?
Only for a second. There's plenty of ordinarily just selfish people that get in to situations that they just back out of again without necessarily doing anything extraordinarily wrong. Just
the way that she looked. You know, I mean, I don't feel like that they put a lot of that stuff in there. Just like, I don't think it's like actor's choice whether you like look upset or happy or weirded out or whatever. Like, I don't think it's like that. I feel like that it's put there like how she's meant to feel. And when she says, good old Elliot, it didn't come off like, I really miss him and I wonder how things went. It comes off like,
Tom also reveals that Kevin is not his own biological dad.
But that definitely like Kevin had been like a good loving dad with him. But this did point out that both Tom and Meg essentially felt pretty orphaned, right?
Yeah, yeah. And the fact that Meg's mom has been deceased for a while also comes out.
And that they shot her mother into space. Yeah, that was kind of funny and
weird,
wacky.
Weird factoid there.
I feel like, okay, now I haven't seen this at all, but knowing our viewing party of our fellow lefties, I want to say that it would not strike me as odd at all if they took that space reference as to be like, see, that's why I said aliens are totally involved. Because I have heard some alien talk. The Daily Review does not feel aliens are involved.
No, I don't think so. So the next natural thing to happen is Meg starts kissing Tom. Totally makes sense.
Well, she's all about using everything she's got here, okay? And for Tom, the way to Tom is absolutely, if some men are through their stomachs, his is not.
Well, he's still a young man.
Absolutely, absolutely. And she's a beautiful woman. I mean, no doubt he can't believe this is happening. And he actually says, what is happening right now?
And they head out to the dance floor. And they start to dance around. And so she says the most bizarre thing.
Well, the music that's playing in the background is that song where it's like, I'm sorry, I'm just thinking of the right thing to say. It's like, I promise you, I promise you. There's all this like weird alluding like to like this, like, I know this is awkward, but I'm trying to think of the right words to say to you, blah, blah, blah. So she leans into his ear and she says, to get you pregnant.
And Tom's like,
like, what?
That's not how that works.
Oh, no, I think he's like, I don't even know what you're talking about, because it came out of nowhere. They'd been talking for like a while.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden she's all like, to get you pregnant. So he's like, what? And so she says, like, I effed you basically to get you pregnant. Then she turns on her heel and awkwardly leaves him on the dance floor. Which is mean, y'all. That's mean. Don't do that.
And he has no idea what to do besides just follow her like a dummy.
Yeah. Or a little puppy. We could say a puppy, right?
Because we're a dumb puppy.
Because our metaphor is that he's an Australian sheepdog, right?
I guess.
So he's going to follow. He's going to follow. They continue on their car trip, road tripping it, if you will, and they show up to Texas. And I wrote down that they encounter...
Well, I bet this honky-tonk might have been in Texas.
Maybe.
I bet it wasn't in, like, you know, Connecticut.
Well, they came through, like, Kentucky and whatever. I don't know. They're on their way down. I don't know. Whatevs. Could have been Tennessee, Paul. You don't even know. Like, when's the last time you honky-tonked?
Where do honkies tonk?
I don't know, Paul. Is that like, how much wood could a woodchuck chuck? Like, where do honkies tonk?
Yes.
Nice. Nice. Well, I suppose that answers Texas. So they pull up to who I wrote down in my notes as a Bubba man. Now, Bubbas, for you to know, are very nice gentlemen, but they are definitely going to be wearing plaid, probably sleeveless, definitely a baseball cap, some facial hair, and they're just sort of like the guy who's always waiting outside. He's like our Bubba.
This man is not to be trifled with. He's carrying a rifle. He is a plainclothes GR member.
Which, freaky. I didn't even know there were these. Because although Meg has definitely been a scofflaw, most of the time she is still wearing white, and he's not wearing white.
This, as we will come to be more familiar with, looks to be a side project of Meg's own design.
He writes on a sheet that there's a situation.
Situation.
So Meg says, open the chain.
She drives up, and another man approaches the car, another plainclothes GR guy, and he starts trying to write out what's going on. And she's like, just say what is happening. And apparently there's a trespasser.
Basically, it sounds like that there's like a bike path that's like a mile behind this compound that they're on. And it sounded like that the boy just kind of got off the bike track and was kind of riding his bike around. And they found him over by the barn.
Did he see it? Yeah, we think he saw it. Well, stone him.
Yikes. So Meg is like a freakazoid. So we have to endure him, that bike boy screaming and hollering that he didn't do anything. Meg just stalks off to head to the barn.
Tom follows her, and she's like, what?
Now, this part totally was that kind of part, right? Where, like, the high school girl or whatever is like, you know, one night, like, dancing with him when nobody can see, and then the next day being like, why are you following me? God, what do you want? He's all like, I don't know what else I'm supposed to be doing. Like, what the what?
She's like, you wanted to be in Texas, so now you are. And so
she's all, make yourself useful, and like picks up a rock and gives it to him. Gross.
And he sees the other GR members dragging the trespasser out.
Gross.
And he drops the rock, and he can't really intervene in what's happening over there. So he just wanders off.
I think he's just trying to think about what am I supposed to do now? So we see that Meg does like a secret shave and a haircut knock on the door, and then just heads on in.
Later that night, Tom is waiting across in kind of this open air hall.
It's like like I would consider it like a kind of like a dining hall kind of sitch or whatever. Like
where he can keep an eye on wherever it was that Meg went into. I think he's waiting for her to come back out.
Yeah, so a chick comes over and is all like, you wrote down on a piece of paper, you came with Meg. Tom nods and she writes, she's going to change everything.
Meg does come out, and she gets in her car and takes off.
We get a dose of Olivia Newton-John you have to believe we are magic, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it, you know, it struck me when we were listening to this that the soundtrack is so different than when we have been with Kevin. Kevin's soundtrack is so heavy metal and like heart pumping stuff. Meg's soundtrack, how would you describe it? Is it like 70s music?
I think Olivia Newton-John is very early 80s.
I don't know.
But
it's
the important
like
part
so
is
different.
She's Australian.
And if you guys remember, in real life, Olivia Newton-John's husband faked his own disappearance. So a little nod to fake disappearances.
She steers her way to the encampment where she gets out and does what she said she was going to do. She takes a look.
Stares at the bridge.
At the bridge.
And, she, and guess who comes up behind her? Reverend Jameson.
Who looks dapper in his ripped flannel shirt.
I know, right? Looks like he got into some sort of like monkey knife fight. I don't know what happened. He's like, Megan, my God, what are you doing here?
And they catch up like old friends, even though they never were.
And I'm going to say old friends who are highly skeptical of one another. So he's all, you left a remnant? Good for you.
And she's like, mm-hmm, sure.
Yeah, I was looking
totally
for you.
Totally left them.
And she, I mean, he has to introduce himself, like, oh, you know, come on. So old Meg says, you know, boy, they just aren't suffering like the rest of us are, you know, are they?
Well, before that happens, Matt does fill her in on his business.
Oh my God. So this is the same, whatever truth serum happens that Jill blabbered everything to Michael and Tom blathers everything. Now Matt blathers his whole life story over to Meg.
About how Kevin and Nora are taking care of Mary and how he can't get back into town right now.
Right. And Meg's like, that's no fair.
Matt is using his pretty uncanny truth detection powers right now, the same way that he was able to get to the bottom of things with everybody so far.
But you know who like it specifically reminded me of? I remember the casino owner who was like, I have no interest in giving you any information about our patrons. And then he sort of like Jedi mind tricked him into like being like, I do want to tell you our surveillance information.
Yeah.
Like it was kind of similar. Like he's like, hey, Megan, I don't think you're being entirely truthful with me. But guess what? Meg's got her own Jedi mind tricks. He also says, today's the anniversary. And she's like, no, the departure anniversary is tomorrow. And he's like, no. The anniversary of your mother's death. Let's talk about that for a couple minutes. Hey, remember how I used to like make flyers with your mother's face on it and be all weird and stand in the cul-de-sac and yell?
Yeah, it was just like last year you came out and beat me up. Remember that? Good times.
And he's all, hey, you know what? I apologize for being your living reminder. So Meg takes this chance to say all, hey, can I ask you something? And you know what? I have to tell you something, guys. I honestly thought she was going to be like, what's it like to fuck a woman in a coma? That's what I really legit thought she was going to say. Really, really. Because she had to say something mean to him, right? So she's all like, hey, can I ask you something? What are you guys waiting for out here? You are so close. You are almost in there. And then you're just sitting out here, not doing anything. You want it, but you're not doing anything to get it. And there's only like a beat. And Matt's giving her like the kind of face. And she's all, you want me to tell you the answer?
And Matt says, yes.
Which is kind of weird. Don't you think that was kind of weird? It reminded me of his voice when he goes, what? We got a tent.
It reminded me more of when John was intimidating him in the visitor center.
What does he say?
When John was telling him to recant his story. For a brief moment, Matt was agreeing to, to do
so. Yeah,
so
it's almost like an out-of-body experience, though, the face he makes, you know?
Yeah.
And so Meg says, you've been waiting for me. WTF, what does that mean?
Well, I think it means that she's going to pull some shit.
Yeah, but what does it mean to Matt? What is it like? What is she trying to say to him?
To me, if I was Matt, I would read that as one of those you'll know it when you see it kind of moments.
I wrote eek on my paper. So back to the compound, we see Tom, who has decided, you know, here's what I'm thinking. I'm thinking that the GR is sleeping pretty hard tonight because I think it would probably
They're all lined up in their little sleeping hall on
the
floor.
Yeah, but do you know why, though? Do you know how much energy it would take to stone a person to death? First of all, you got to walk around and go find all those rocks. I'm sorry, but that's going to take you some time. Texas is not all about that big cobblestone that she pulled up or whatever. That big, like, river rock or whatever. What the? That does not exist around here. So I'm just, like, letting you know that would take a lot of work. A lot of work to find the right sized baseball sized stones to be hucking at somebody. Step two, hello. Didn't take, like, a while to get Gladys really going. And to really make the person dead, I think you probably have to throw, like, a lot of stones. I think your muscles and your arms are probably burning. And you have just tuckered yourself out. You are ready for a
really
long nap.
Earned a good rest here.
I'm saying, if you try to kill someone by stoning, you might sleep well that night. Tom takes this opportunity for these little tuckered out Muppets to just sneak out the back. And you know what's so interesting? That barn door that required a like, dip, 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 and was like well guarded is now suddenly like a screen door that Tom just walks right in. And no one's there.
No one's there, yeah. Like, they don't post a guard at night. Like,
and there's no guard inside.
Like, they just use the honor system at
there's
night.
There's no nothing. However, if you're found even lurking about, we're gonna stone you to death. But we're not gonna bother to put anybody around to, you know, keep you away from the perimeter.
Inside the barn, they find a pretty non-barn item, an Airstream trailer.
Which, if you recall, when she was back talking with Matt, staring at the bridge, there was a flash where she sees this exact Airstream trailer sitting dead center on the bridge. Now, funny that I say dead center on the bridge, because I recognize that as the space that we had talked about right where Kevin and the troll man had been having their little chit-chat in Purgatory Land. And there was that moment where he's all, are you going to cross or are you going to jump? So seeing this part of the bridge totally flashed me back to nooses on the bridge. Worrisome. If Tom was being a sneaky little dude, he goes over to the Airstream, and I gotta say, I don't know if they were just running out of time in this episode or what, but he doesn't even attempt to open the door in any sort of way that would not leave massive damage.
Yeah, he just kind of jiggles the handle a little bit, but then he goes straight to looking for gigantic tools.
Now, here's the thing. So he has to be thinking in his head, whatever I find in here, like, I'm leaving this whole GR situation. Because it doesn't make any sense that he would have done anything that would have damaged the vehicle in such a way that, like, without a doubt, everyone knows he broke into it, you know?
Yeah.
Like, there was no going
like,
back
who would have
from
done
that.
This?
Yeah,
maybe
the
new
guy that just showed up. Right, exactly. So, oh my God, he does break the door open, and he just stares into our camera for a few minutes. In awe.
What we see next leaves us in awe.
Oh my God, totally.
Because we are looking...
Did you think he was looking at like an entire Airstream packed with explosives?
No.
No, you knew?
No, I didn't knew, but...
Well, what did you think he was looking at? What was he making that blah face at? Did you think it was packed with diamonds and gold? Naked ladies? What? What do you think it was?
I just watched the show.
You didn't even try to guess as he was just gazing in. It totally reminded me of Pulp Fiction again. You know, every time when they would open the briefcase and you just see like a glow on the person's face and they'd go like, gah, 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 like that at it. It reminded me of that. But I didn't expect what it was.
It was Evie and the other two.
Dressed all in white, clearly indicating that they were GR members. Evie was standing up and that one chick was being super weird and, like, hanging on Evie's leg. What the what?
Tom's like, who are you?
And in true GR style.
Evie writes on the pad, it doesn't matter.
And slams the door.
And that's it.
OMG.
So this, except for the naked running part.
It certainly gave us all the information that we needed to know. So clearly, Meg and Evie met. They, at some point in time, Paul was telling me that he had read the book, and in the book, they do use the internet to recruit people.
The GR used the internet in the book, right.
So it makes complete sense to me that Meg would have gotten in contact with Evie via the internet. There's probably a lot of different ways that she could have been involved with her and, you know, clearly got her the burner phone or whatever and the cricket sound. Now we understand what that was throughout the house. That's my guess. it is a question mark to me about whether Meg, you know, ever was in that house or not. They did really send it on home to us over and over again that Evie's mom takes her hearing aids out at night and her dad sleeps like a rock. So the idea that there could be any amount of like fooling around that house seems like highly likely, doesn't it?
For sure. All the little smirks that the girls gave each other when they were singing their school song. And
oh, and you pointed out such a good thing, how basically it was such an act for the girls to be acting so silly and boisterous and all that kind of stuff. Because then when they were in the car and we had that moment where they were completely silent, it did make us wonder like, oh man, were they either A, practicing for the GR, or B, were they just putting on this act on the outside? Were they silent all the time whenever they could be, I guess, and only were speaking and acting so silly and stuff when they felt like they were like trying to put on an act for the rest of the town.
Right. The act was for us. The GR was their actual selves.
Right.
And that was how they acted with each other.
Right. So the naked running in the woods is still a little bit of a question mark for sure. I mean, I think that we could surmise a couple different things. Because we saw them wearing all white in the Airstream, it kind of makes sense to me on some level that maybe they did ditch their clothes somewhere and they were running through the woods to get to wherever the compound was. And maybe Evie was raising her arms like, yeah, you know, we completed the mission kind of thing. The only thing that's weird is that they're running through the woods in the day, aren't they? I mean, we can see them, so it can't be night, right?
No.
And then definitely the departure biz, or however you want to say now, the runaway, happened at night. So that's like still kind of weird. Do you think maybe they were just practicing? Although I still don't get why you'd run naked.
I do think it was a practice run, but still, why it needed to be completely naked is still kind of curious.
Maybe do you think it comes under that whole leaving all your worldly possessions behind kind of thing? Some sort of weird, like you were saying, I thought that was a really good clue in there that Meg was hanging on to that one sweater, and that is the sweater that Lori took away from her later. So, man, her rage is deep, man. So what do you think? What's going to happen? We got the season finale. It's so exciting. We're a little nervous because we have not heard whether season 3 has been greenlit yet. We have our fingers crossed, and I know there's been a couple different sort of grassroots efforts to get HBO's attention and let them know that we adore The Leftovers and we absolutely want to see season 3 and more. There's been a lot of talk. Where do you think season 3 would take place, Paul, if they do have it? Hopefully they do. Will we stay in Jardin or are we heading out?
I think they could still do some stuff in Jardin, but something tells me that they wouldn't stay there very long.
Do you think it would be like half a season kind of thing, or what do you think? How would it work?
No telling.
Will we go back to Australia, or will we go to Australia? Will we go back to Mapleton? Where will we go?
Well, I think Mapleton's completely 100% done. Australia seems like there's some storytelling there. Without knowing what happens in the next episode, it's hard to tell, because I could see a couple different things happening just from what we know in this episode. Like, I think the explosive part that they mentioned to Meg, I just don't see that happening. It could. I mean, it obviously could.
So you're questioning about what's going to happen in episode 10 here.
Yeah, I mean, there's a preview out there where they show a truck busting through the gate onto the bridge, and a lot of commotion about the bridge.
So, and they definitely have Meg, like, handcuffed, like, on the ground, or at least kind of apprehended. But she's given a massive smirk looking to the side, which means I'm guessing she's looking at whatever is going to happen on the bridge there. Now, they also keep showing Erica and John and other people running at something.
My big fat guess is that no one is blowing up the bridge. I just don't see this show blowing up the bridge. I just don't see that.
Okay.
I mean, do you?
No, I mean, I don't really know. The thing is that what I keep trying to wrap my mind around is this concept that what makes the town special is the town itself. So even if Evie and her pals utilize those nooses that we know we saw on that bridge, and they do something and they jump off the bridge and they dangle down there, I did think of stuff like, remember the troll man whispers something to Kevin? I had this idea of like, what if he says something like, anytime we kill a child in this realm, a child has to die back in the other realm. Like, it's just what happens. There's a trade-off. So if you go and kill Patty down the well, there's going to be a child that has to die in the real world here. Now, we know that Kevin was driving one of the girls' cars, the car that they disappeared from or whatever. So listening to Virgil and remembering that we're not supposed to think in straight lines. We're not supposed to think like, well, but then Kevin went before, then how could Evie already be dead, blah, blah. If we're supposed to think in spirals and zigzags and blah, 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 then could Evie and the girls have already been dead before Kevin had to come do this business? Could they have already been dangling from those ropes? That's why he has the car available to him. And I know that seems all out of order, but that's only because we want to think linearly.
Yeah.
But could that have all been already happening?
Two things.
And wait, hold on, one more thing. And if you commit suicide by most of this stuff, most of these accounts, aren't you like, don't you have to stay in purgatory? Like old Virgil?
Yeah.
Like, aren't you kind of stuck? I don't know. By some beliefs, I thought you're kind of stuck.
Well, some beliefs you go straight to hell. But
whoa, that's a very sad belief.
I think the Airstream is going to pull up and the girls are going to jump out and hang themselves. I think that's what's
they're
going
to hang off the side of the bridge. And what makes sense to me is that they've showed Tom with the axe that breaks open the Airstream. And one of the things that makes sense to me, I was telling Paul, that made me feel like that Chekhov's gun business where once you see it, then it has to come back into play later. I totally felt like it was so unnecessary to use an axe to open the Airstream. Like, that wasn't any kind of tool that made even any sense. You might have looked around in the barn for a crowbar or something else. It seemed really strange to use an axe, but an axe would make perfect sense to cut somebody off of the bridge, right? To cut a dangling rope. And we know that Erica and people are like going to be running, and Erica's got these healing powers. Here's my ugh. What in the world does any of this prove? Like, what is the GR's message or anything, really? Because them having the girls jump off the bridge and hang themselves doesn't take away from the specialness of Miracle. It doesn't make the town, the bridge is not even on, in the town. So it doesn't take away the magical powers of Jardin at all.
But it does give them a black eye. It does give them something to suffer with related to...
Sort of only from the standpoint of it's sad that those poor troubled teens did that. Not from the standpoint of our town has supernatural powers and blah, blah, blah. That was my only thing that I'm a little like, why did those three girls dying, again, not even in the town, why would that hurt the average citizen there? It would be sad, but it doesn't actually
It's not to hurt them. It's to remind them of the departure, because the people of Jardin had never had anything to remind them of it ever. Because it never touched them.
Yes, but none of this has to do with the departure. It was a fake departure. So no girls did depart.
But that's why they're doing it, to remind them of the departure.
I don't know. I have a hard time. It's not a good link. I mean, it's not a very good plan of Meg's. Like, it doesn't do it for me. There would have to be something else. Like, you would think she would want to reveal Isaac as a fake or something. Like, there's just, like, nothing there, you know, that it doesn't do enough for me. I don't know. I know. I do remember that Isaac says that something really terrible is going to happen to John. Do you think that anyone else is going to die in their place? Do you think Erica is going to die trying to save them? Who, what, where? How's this going to happen? Do you think Tom is going to cut them down? Do you think that Matt's going to catch someone from below?
Well, cutting them down isn't exactly like a surefire safety net kind of
thing. No, but they could break their legs and not be dead. But I do think that Matt and the encampment people being down below, there could absolutely be a moment where Matt is like a savior, where he literally catches Evie. And I mean, you know, Jesus died for our sins. Evie is the representative of Eve in the garden, right? Committing a sin, killing yourself. And then Jesus all comes and saves there. I don't know. There's a lot there compared to just, well, they want to give Miracle a black eye. It doesn't seem like Meg wanted to do something. Like, she kept saying, it's amazing. It's amazing what I'm doing in Texas. I don't know. That doesn't seem that amazing. To convince a couple of troubled teens to hang themselves publicly, that's the black eye.
You don't think that would be pretty dramatic if that happened to a town of just like 10,000 people? Like that wouldn't be kind of a big deal to those people?
Yes, but I don't make any connection to the departure to that. Like none. That could happen tomorrow in any small town and no one would be like, that makes me remember this time. Like, no, it has no link. It's like, it's very sad. It's troubled teens. It's suicide. It's awful. But it doesn't, to me, have any reminder. The things that they did in the finale of season one, heck yeah, man, that was a reminder, you know? I mean, that was a reminder. That was horrible. That was a mind-twisting mess. But revealing the GR as kidnappers and brainwashing of children, again, is sort of like, oh boy, I don't know. Does that make the GR look horrible? Does it really make the town look bad? What did the town do? I can't come up with a good reason why it takes away any special powers from Miracle. I would love to see, like, something more to this. There's got to be. Do you think Kevin is going to turn out to be the hero? He certainly was in season one's finale. We sure haven't seen him in a long time, having to do with this whole storyline.
Yeah, he's going to, I don't know if he's going to be the hero, but he's going to emerge from the ground here, and he's going to
right
come in
the
on the scene.
Timing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think there's going to be something heroic that he pulls.
He's one of the only people who would recognize Meg for what she is. Matt and Kevin would be the two people that would be able to recognize Meg for who she is, you know? Because if they're all wearing plain clothes, let's assume they are.
And Matt might not see it right away.
What do you think is going to happen when it comes to Nora and her whole storyline? Where is she? Is she coming back?
Well, I've seen a picture of her out by the bridge with everybody holding Lily. So somehow she gets out there. I don't know why, what role she possibly has bringing Lily out there, but yeah, I've seen her out there.
How about this for freakiness? Haven't they been calling Lily the bridge? Or there's some thought that Lily could be the bridge?
I remember that, but I mean, wasn't that when she was supposed to be a boy?
Don't you think that's a little odd to be calling a baby a bridge and then it's ending on a bridge?
Freaky, but all that Holy Wayne stuff. I know that there's more supernatural stuff to the show than just the departure, but I don't know if Holy Wayne was one of those things or not.
I got weird. Okay, right. Wait, are you ready for this? This is some weird business, okay? Wrap your brain around this. Okay, remember how we were saying that the character of Evie is Evangeline, and then you have Lily,
mm-hmm.
right? And there's this whole thought of, like, if things are not linear, and we all come back as little baby carrots and little green peas, what if Lily is Evangeline come back round? We got Evie offering up baby carrots.
Okay.
I know it's crazy, but who cares? I mean, that's the idea, right? Is just like, how nutty could this be? They're definitely, if you do not think linearly, and you think just like, could one character be another character at another point in time? Could she have been reborn as this little baby? And if you just cut off that one part that they already point blank said, stop thinking linearly. They already told you that.
Yeah, but those rules applied to the other place.
Maybe.
Well, specifically, Virgil in the white car said these are the rules here.
Then how is the white car in Purgatory? How's the white car there when the white car is supposed to be in Austin or whatever they said they were sending it? Like, we didn't see any other overlap. It's not like there were other characters who were totally alive and or any other thing that we saw in the other world represented there. The birds were there, but the birds were dead in the ground. Virgil was there, but Virgil had killed himself. How could the car be there and the car be in Austin in the real world? At some point, I think you cross over, right? At some point, it crosses over. I don't know how to, I mean, my own mind can't wrap around the concept of like spiral time and stuff like that. But all I'm saying is that we had made a connection between Evangeline and Lily, and that being one character, Evangeline Lily, right? That being one person's name.
Yeah, yeah.
We had made that connection a long time ago, and they keep saying Lily's a bridge. Whether or not you believe it or not, that's what the characters have repeatedly told you. That baby is going to be the bridge, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm just putting it out there that what if there's some sort of wigginess and we've got this theme song singing about how you're coming back like little carrots and little green beans, whatever. Okay, what? I don't know. Just putting it out there. I don't know what's going on here. It's crazy. I am loving it. I'm loving all the speculation. You know, I saw one thing where people complain that, you know, answers come with questions. And I saw the little interview with Damon where he said that the reason why they had Patty go on Jeopardy is because the answer comes in the form of a question. Oh, Damon, you card. I love it. So that could be the entire theme of Damon's shows are answers come in the form of questions. So I hope we've answered some of your questions today. And if you have a lot more, then please come on over to dailyreview.com. Join us on Facebook at Daily Review or Twitter. And we would love, love, love to hear your thoughts. Love to spin all different kinds of ideas with you guys. Thanks so much for listening.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks for listening, pod people. Thanks for listening to my mom and dad.
You don't have to go home, but you can't stay here. Just go home, folks.